All right, welcome back to another episode of We All Speak in Poems. Today I'm chatting with Kyle McDougall. Kyle is a YouTuber who has amassed well over 100,000 subscribers through his photography-based videos. He is also a successful photographer with a book out called An American Mile, and is currently working on his next one called Slate City. If you like this episode, I'd highly recommend checking out and supporting his work. And with that being said, I hope you enjoy this episode. So I wanted to start right off in the middle of what you're currently working on. You have two main projects, like long-term projects, according to your YouTube. But it's the one I wanted to focus on mainly right now was the World War II one that you put out two videos for. I wanted to know where you're currently at with it, because I was just watching the videos even this morning again. And it's so interesting that the way that you're sort of documenting it and whatnot. Like, are you documenting everything, or are you just kind of leaving some stuff behind the scenes?
So it's funny that when you posed this question and you said the two long-term projects, I was thinking in my head, like, please ask me about the one in Wales. and the reason I kind of favored that one is because that is the project that I'm doing that's like really solidified and like this is absolutely a thing. The World War II stuff, I actually just pulled that portfolio from my website, like just put it to like hidden, because it's something that very much excites me, but it's, I'm learning how much projects change, especially like over the first few years for me at least. So this one is based around the RAF and the Air Force here in the United Kingdom and documenting these basically like lost airfields. So the one thing I've realized, as you know, I've lived here for longer, is the kind of closer you look, you start to find all these things, and just learning more about the history of World War II and the RAF and how many airfields there were, and then, you know, seeing that there's traces of these still all over the country just fascinated me so much. So the reason why I pulled that recently is I think just as it started to develop a little bit, it's been me starting to think, like, how do I portray this in the best way possible? And what started to, like, you know, obviously you go to these places and there's a lot of, like, well, in some of them there's the old structure still, everything's decaying, everything's kind of abandoned, and I guess I'm just cautious and thinking a lot in my mind, like, how do I make a project about this without it just being photographs of old falling things that are falling apart, you know, because it almost feels like not disrespectful, because I guess there isn't much left. So I guess I'm just trying to find like the balance of how do you photograph a subject like this and do it in a way that's going to be like most impactful, but also I guess just portray this history in the best light possible, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And I honestly feel like that's probably pretty exciting to sort of have to restructure the whole thing, you know, in a way, like, because I'm assuming what will end up coming from this is like a better project in the end, right? No matter how long it takes. But with that being said, then, I don't actually know too much about the other project you're doing. If you want to go over that a little bit.
Sure. I think it's actually a decent example of exactly kind of what you just mentioned about like restructuring, because for me, I'm really, I don't want to say bad at, but my way of operating is I'll get an idea. As soon as an idea comes to me, I'll try and like formulate it in my head, and I'll be like, the project's going to be about this, and this is how I'm going to do it. And forgetting that these things change so much. So Slate City is a project documenting a specific area in North Wales, this town called Blenheim Ffestiniog, which used to be considered the slate capital of the world. And you go up there, and basically the surrounding landscape in this town is like mountains of slate waste. Like, it's just incredible, and there's old quarries and there's stuff everywhere. So that is a project that I started about almost right when I moved over to England. So about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago. But it started out as like just simply photographing these old quarry sites, and then slowly starting to learn about the history. And then I narrowed it down to that area of this one specific town as I learned about it, you know, you how it used to be the slate capital of the world. And even still, like, the more I learn about the history and the more I kind of dig into the research, it shifts, like, it narrows the focus. It brings in new creative ideas. So it's like, I had an idea at the start and it took almost 3 years for it to develop and narrow down into, like, a clear focus. So the World War II stuff, you know, I started it 6 months ago. I've pulled it from my website, but there's a very good chance that 3 years from now, I'll probably be deep into it and it'll look, maybe it's about one specific squadron or one specific, maybe it's just documenting artwork from, you know, the US Air Force when they're here. Like, there's so many ways that things can go.
For sure. I mean, yeah, exactly. I think that the way that you do it, and I'm sure a lot of people also do it, but I'm not quite aware of them, like, digging into the history, telling the story of, you know, the town, the city, for the slate quarry, and, like, really diving deep, you know, it's not just photography, it really is telling the story. I think that's really inspiring, especially for someone who, like me, you know, you can only, take photos of so much. You're like, oh, I haven't picked up my camera in 4 months, you know?
For sure.
I think that's a really interesting way of sort of going about it and diving deep for a while. But, like, I'm assuming that you also go through those periods where it's like, I don't even want to take a photo of anything.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, it's funny you say that, because literally right now I'm finishing up a video for my YouTube channel, which is, I just went through this month of, like, really, like, pretty bad creative burnout. You know, going through the moments where I'm like, oh, do I even like photography anymore? And, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then I went through, like, a week and a half period near the end of it where I just kind of stopped working how I typically do. And I, you know, started experimenting with things and playing around and just kind of having fun, which kind of rejuvenated me and brought, like, a lot of excitement back. So basically I'm talking about, like, the ebb and the flow, you know, these periods of production where you're on, and then how important it is to make sure you have these periods where you're off and you're playing and I think it's just really easy at times to, like, forget that you can just pick up a camera and go out for a day and just, like, shoot because it's fun. Like, it doesn't have to be like, I gotta get images to post on social media, or I have to make images for my project or whatever. Like, we were away last week and I brought all my gear, and I ended up just going out one morning with my iPhone and shooting in square mode and just, like, you know, zero expectations, like, for anything. And it was just, like, a really fun, enjoyable time. So that stuff's, yeah, I think, equally as important.
Exactly. And I think it's also important to, like, you know, because everybody's in this gear mode for the past few years of, like, the only way you can experiment is by getting new gear, but there's thousands of ways that you can mess around with the current gear you have, right? Even, like you said, your iPhone. But, like, what we were doing, me and Chantel were doing recently, because her grandma gave her this really old, like, kaleidoscope. Just put the kaleidoscope in front of the lens, you know? That, yeah, is, like, an hour of fun. And it doesn't really produce anything, but, you know, you're using your camera, you know what I mean?
Well, and you never know as well. Like, out of all of these experiments, you never know what it might spark. Like, I think stuff like that is important as well, because you can get just, I think, rigid with, like, a specific way of working and think that that's how everything you do needs to be done. Like, even with Slate City, I picked up like a pinhole camera recently, and this is something I've never ever had any interest in. But when I was doing research recently, looking at old photographs from the area, it just, like, sparked the idea of, could I use a different tool for a few select images? Like, get away from this, like, everything needs to be on large format film and, like, perfect. Could I kind of, like, emulate some of the look of these images from the 1900s and use a tool in a creative way where I work in just, like, things to switch it up a little bit? I think I'm being more attracted to that the longer I'm involved with photography. It's just, like, how can I get away from, like, the formula, you know, yeah, of, like, a project, and just not try and, like, reinvent the wheel, but just, like, you know, do something a little bit different or add in little different creative elements.
And I think even as, like a viewer, a consumer of your photography and other people's photography, it's kind of the same way. Like, for a while when you're first getting into it, yeah, you love the, you know, the resolution of certain photos or, like, the color theory. But what you end up liking in the future, from my experience, is, like, the stuff that doesn't look like it's very hard to take, but it, like, I don't know, it resonates for some reason, right? And I think that, yeah, goes exactly with what you're saying. It's like, it adds so much to have, you know, a pinhole camera in this, because it, especially with a project like that, it just makes sense as well, you know, to be sort of paired up.
For sure. For sure. Just thinking of ways you can, I guess it all comes down to just being creative, right? Like, you don't just have to use like a high resolution camera and do things a certain way. Even a friend of mine whose last project he did large format color, just like really like incredible images. I was talking to him the other day about some new work he's doing, and he's just talking about taking this complete different approach in terms of like tools used and focus, like subject matter and stuff, just to almost like surprise people a little bit. And I love that, because I'm very much one of the types of people where in my head I'm like, this is the tool I'll use, and this is how I'll do my approach, and I'm going to keep doing that for the next 40 years.
Yeah.
Which I don't want. I don't want that to be my approach. So yeah, it's good to just, I think, yeah, play, switch things up every now and then.
Exactly, exactly. So for bigger projects like, you know, both World War II and Slate City one, what's the title of that one? Is it Slate City? Or
Slate City, yeah.
Okay, okay, cool. What does like the project mean to be finished? Like, is the goal here to have it and have a book of it? Is the goal here to just have your side of things done and like we're good to go, or how do you sort of finish things off?
So I think ever since publishing my first book with my work from the American West, my goal moving forward with all my projects is to publish them as a book. So okay. Yeah, Slate City, absolutely, I want to be one. And with the World War II stuff, I would say like, yes, for sure. I haven't thought that far ahead yet, but with Slate City, it's even something I've started to think of a little bit of like what that might look like when it's done. But it's nice to bring, like, especially with An American Mile, my first book that I published, like that work never started as a project. So it was really neat to bring it all together and almost like close things out with a book. It really felt like it kind of wrapped that up, and then you have this physical object, and I really like that idea. Otherwise, I could see myself just like tinkering for years, you know?
Yeah.
Like I'll be going to Wales 30 years from now making images of this lake or being like, oh, I got another one to add in. So I like that. I like the idea of like a physical object to wrap up something.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's kind of the same with me. Like for my last record, we did a vinyl, and then we also did a photo book with poetry in it as well, where I teamed up with my buddy Ben Espajani, who's a poet, and we just used like some of the photos that I took, and it was a super small run that sold out, thankfully. I mean, it was only like 25 copies, but it just sort of concreted the fact that it was done, you know. Mm. And I could sort of move on to the next thing, and that's kind of the way I think about it as well. But I wanted to ask a little bit, so have you ever self-published, or has it always been with a publisher, like,
yes,
the actual books?
So that the first book I did in American Mile was with a publisher, which was really nice, and that's, I guess, actually I don't know what I would do for the next one, but I'm very much someone who tries to do a lot of stuff myself, sometimes out of necessity.
Yeah.
But oftentimes just because, which always, you know, certainly is not the best way to work. So working with a publisher for me, you know, looking back now, I'm just like, it was such a huge help, because from like design to getting help with sequencing to just having someone who had connections with a printer and fulfillment warehouses and all of this stuff that would have, you know, taken me so much extra time just to A, figure out, and then B, handle moving forward. So yeah, this one was with the publisher, and I think that's probably the route I would go with moving forward as well.
For sure. Yeah, because in the music industry, there's always that, the conversation now in the last, you know, 10 years or so is like independent artists versus like label artists, like are labels worth it, all this stuff. Is there the same sort of conversation going on in photography at all, or is it kind of just doesn't really matter all that much?
You know what, to be honest with you, I am not that experienced in the photo book publishing world. So I don't, like, not that I know of, you know, In terms of like conversations like that going on. But I mean, it's I would say it's one of those things maybe similar to the music industry where nowadays it's easier than ever to be independent from like, I guess from say if you want to publish a photo book, there's more options to do that than ever. And with the technology we have and stuff, whereas if you wanted to, you know, self-publish 10 years ago, it was probably a pretty difficult thing. So
for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even, me and Chantal, whenever we go on trips, we'll get a book, you know, printed, you know, even though it's very expensive to print just one, but, you know, it's definitely fun.
And the quality is probably getting better, I would imagine, and the options and stuff like that.
Yeah, even like the cover and stuff, like the type of materials you can use and like the embossing and the, you know, the thickness of the paper and the ink that you use. It's actually really crazy. And it's really fun to get into the weeds of it, I think.
For sure.
But yeah, I mean, it's a tough conversation, especially when there's pros to both sides, especially when you have an audience like you sort of have already. It goes into the question of is the publisher bringing value, which I'm assuming in photography, they bring more value than in music because it's harder to publish a photography book than just putting stuff on Spotify for music. You know what I mean?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess it all depends. Like the publisher I worked with is a good friend of mine now who had a pretty big audience built through his business already, you know, publishing books and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, definitely it was like our two audiences kind of meshed together. But I guess it depends, right? Like, I think it's really tough nowadays because online there's just so much, I don't want to say noise, but there's so much of it. Everyone's online. There's so much photography. So I think it can be challenging if you haven't built up an audience yet to say, just be like, I'm going to publish a book. And then it's hard to, you know, get people interested in it. Because I think nowadays you have to do more than just put up good work because there's so much good work out there. And I think it's building like a connection with people and having, you know, I hate the word providing value, but just like, you know, building a connection with people and putting out stuff and helping people. And like the way I've always looked at it is like when I published my book and I announced that it was up for sale, that was the first time in like 4 years of having social media accounts and stuff that I ever said, hey, I'm selling something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's
so
hard. Yeah.
So, but I think at that point, people who had followed me for that amount of time were just really interested to be like, oh, cool. Like, I've enjoyed what you've done, so I'll grab a copy. This is obviously me making assumptions in my head, but that's just how I look at it. If there's artists or musicians that I follow, you kind of, even though you don't know the person, you find someone's work you like, or you like what they're putting out there, and you kind of want to support them at some point when they offer something.
Exactly. Yeah. I totally get that. And even for me, like when I started putting out like physical products, vinyl and stuff, it was really hard to ask somebody to spend their hard-earned money on this when it's like you can actually just see it on Spotify. You know,
yeah.
Like, this is just extra. You don't have to do this. And even with that mindset, it's still like, but I'm asking people for their money. You know? it's a weird mindset. And I think that comes with like the digital age and stuff. But yeah, it's definitely interesting.
That's good as well, though, I think, because the flip side is being someone who's like being an artist who's making work and just constantly being like, oh, what can I, you know, sell next? And like weekly being like, got another ebook up or whatever it is, right? Or how to do this. So I think it's cool. And at least for me, the way I see it is like, if I haven't put much stuff out there, it means probably when I am putting something out and announcing that it's for sale, it's something that I feel really proud of. And I would assume it's similar for you with vinyl. Exactly. and things like that.
Exactly. I think it's also interesting, like the time that we're in. I am on YouTube a lot. I like, you know, the YouTube ecosystem or whatever. But the trends that I'm seeing now are like, you know, the Colin and Samir's. How does a YouTuber make as much money as possible?
Mm.
And it's like weird that it's become that instead of like, how do you make the best video possible? I guess because that's super subjective, but it's strange to me. You know, it's kind of done the shift over the last I don't know, probably 5 years ever since the pandemic, probably actually.
Yeah, it's 100%. I mean, there's, I think it's because like the quick fix is so appealing. You know what I mean? The shortcuts are so appealing. And that's even if you go on, if you went online right now and you Googled like, you know, best tips for starting a YouTube channel, everything is about these like growth hacks and, you know, thumbnail optimization. Yeah. And it's like all of that stuff is maybe the like 2% of what matters. Like, sure, I'm sure these tips are useful, but like, you got to focus on what you're saying. You know, like what is the thing you're making and why would someone want to watch it? And is it going to help anyone? That's going to be what, what helps you.
I think it's similar to like the luck conversation. Cause a lot of the time I always say that I'm like super lucky where I am, but like, you know, my parents will say, you know, you're only here though, because when you got lucky, the work spoke for itself, you know? And so you still have to actually try at the video instead of just have the best thumbnail possible or the best title or tags or whatever it is now. That whole side of things is foreign to me, but like I try to dig as deep as possible without actually being in it. And it's just so interesting to me just because there, it almost does seem like there is a formula, you know, with the algorithm, for lack of a better term.
It's funny, for as long as I've been on YouTube and obviously doing it pretty much as like a full-time thing now, I started to enjoy it the most when I let go the most. Cause there is, again, I think there's certain things that matter, but also, I think you can obsess over things. And in the end, like some videos I've been excited about have done the worst, and some videos that I've thought no one's going to like have been the best. And sometimes I post at 4 p.m. on a Tuesday, and sometimes I post at 7 p.m. on a Sunday. And like in the end, you know, it's
exactly in 10 years from now, are you even going to notice like, all the intricacies? I do find it interesting that you even mentioned though, the videos that you didn't think would do well, and then the opposite sometimes, because that seems to be just a common thing with all like sort of art forms, you know, especially now. Like my biggest song was made half an hour the day before I put it out because I didn't have a song for piano day, you know, and I didn't think it was good, and all of a sudden people love it, and I'm like, why? You know, it doesn't make any sense.
That I think that is, there's such an important lesson in that, and something I try and remind myself of often is like, we as the artists aren't the ones to decide if something is good or not.
True.
We have to go, obviously we have our certain like biases and we're, you know, like certain songs or certain photos better than others. But at the end of the day, it's up to the audience to decide what is good and what isn't. And I think remembering that has certainly helped me fight off some of the resistance that I experience almost daily. Like,
for sure.
Every single time I'm working on something, every single time I go to post up a photo or post up a new YouTube video, I'm like, is anyone going to like this? And like, you know, does this suck? Like, does this make any sense? And anyways, keeping that in mind just helps me go click, you know, like publish.
Yeah, exactly. Does that help you at all? Like, because you post weekly, is that your sort of schedule on YouTube?
I'll post weekly for like 3 weeks and then I won't post for like 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's so fair.
Yeah.
But sharing, you know, so often still, even at that rate, I guess that gives you a chance to sort of share without having it like be like, this is my absolute best work. You can kind of like test out the waters a little bit, right? And like, hey, this is a shot I took and it just looks pretty cool. Or even like the most recent one where you're editing those old digital camera stills, right? It's like, this one was pretty good. I wonder if other people will like it, and you sort of edit it until they like it, maybe.
I think for me, it is good, you know, to have variety and try and experiment a little bit. But every single thing I've ever done, every single video that I've ever done, has just purely been based off of like, what is something I can talk about or share that is going to have some sort of purpose behind it. So even that last video was like, the purpose was like, let's look at these old image files as like a reminder that you don't need a $10,000 Hasselblad camera.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but again, I went to put that up and I'm like, is this, you know, is this a stupid video? Like, obviously, I didn't think that because I came up with the idea and wrote the script. But it's always like, once the thing's finished and I'm about to hit post, I'm just like, I don't know. So, yeah. But it is cool to see that. Yeah. I think variety is good.
For sure. Yeah. So to get out of the YouTube sphere a little bit, because I'm sure you talk about YouTube all the time, you know, even though you are a photographer that does you. Do you see yourself as a photographer who does YouTube? Is that kind of how you...
I guess so. Like, the thing is again, not to stick on the YouTube topic, but the strange thing for me is, like, I worked professionally as doing photography and video and television for, like, 10 or 11 years before I started YouTube. And I think there's very much this, this, like, label or image that can get applied to people who are on YouTube that they're just people who know nothing about their craft and started a YouTube channel. So people will, like, comment on my videos and be like, oh, like, this would never work in the real world. And yeah. So I think that is why I would consider myself, yes, a photographer doing YouTube, but, it kind of messes with your mind a little bit when you're on here doing this and you're like, oh wait, I did work professionally for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of what I wanted to get into is, like, before your public, you know, sharing, what were you doing sort of before all this? Like, because you started 6 years ago doing, like, this more public sharing.
Yeah.
From what I can see. So yep. Yeah, you were working as, like, a cinematographer and director.
Yeah. So I went to film school back in early 2000s, got out, and then worked in television for about 7 years. So working as a director of photography and editor for a couple outdoor action sports television shows.
Oh, nice.
So snowmobiling, and then like an all train vehicle one, kind of throughout North America and then some overseas as well. Left that, started a production company with my friend, and we were doing, like, commercial video production work for 3 years after that. And then left that production company. Me and my wife just kind of decided we want to make some changes, and we sold our house, and I got out of the business, and we just went and traveled for a year with a truck and a trailer, which then led to me. That's when I started the YouTube channel, is when we were on the road. Just because I'd done photography the whole time throughout, you know, like my professional career, doing some magazine work and selling prints and stuff. But that was a point where I was like, I was basically off for a year. I had all my gear and I was still being a photographer. We were in the American West. And I, obviously being someone who'd done video for a long time, it was a way to, like, kind of scratch the creative itch of that, and that's why I started making videos. So and then it kind of just snowballed into moving over to England and deciding to pursue that full time. So yeah, there was, like, about a 10-year period though before that of doing commercial production work, documentary work, and then television for a long time.
Wow. I mean, so that explains a lot as to why, like, how you're able to tell these stories and, like, you know, do them so well, you know, high quality, right? Like, especially documentary work, like, that would train you for this technically, right?
And the television stuff very much was, like, you know, minimal bare bones crew, and you're going out and you're the camera operator and you're the director and you're going out for 3 days into the mountains. So it's kind of like the same now for me. I'm just out by myself, you know, with a camera and in these environments with nothing. So it's kind of like all I know, essentially. It was, you know, just lucked out that it was a good match for what I'm doing now.
For sure. Yeah. And you were from Ontario, right?
Yep. Yep.
Were you in the GTA?
Like, yeah. Me? So I grew up in Hamilton.
Okay.
But I was living, when I got out of film school, I was living in, like, the Muskoka area.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, wow. Me and my wife had a house there for a few years, and that's where we left from when we went traveling.
Living the cottage life. Yeah. So what brought you to England of all places?
So my wife is British.
Yeah. It was the easiest move.
Yeah. Okay. So I met her out in Western Canada before I went to film school and stuff like that. And then, she moved over and we lived, in the Muskoka area for like 6 or 7 years for quite a while. And then, just decided to move over here to be closer to family and stuff like that. Basically right in the middle of the pandemic.
Nice. Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Yeah. I mean, my fiance have been talking about, you know, moving just somewhere else for a long time. It's a little bit tougher though. I mean, we'd go to, like, Ottawa instead of,
hey man, Ottawa's pretty nice.
It is.
Yeah.
yeah, that's really cool. So during that time, like before the YouTube channel, all this stuff, and those 10 years, you were doing photography the whole time, pretty much? Like, were there any like specific projects that were you were doing, or was it mostly just like personal, just shooting?
So I actually, before I got into video, I got into photography, and that's what kind of led to like an interest in video and cinematography. But I was big into like landscape photography, and and I went into it kind of as hard as I go into my own work now. It's just that I was sustaining myself with all the video work, so I didn't really need to make it into anything else. I mean, it's funny to say, I had a blog where I like interviewed artists back in the day, and I wrote some articles for like magazines and you know, licensed my work for magazines and stuff like that. Did some shows selling prints and whatnot, but it really was just like I pursued it professionally without having to make it sustainable, I guess. So I still was very much kind of doing what I'm doing now. I had a website, I was updating it, I was shooting all the time. I was, you know, still wanted to try and, I guess, progress as much as I could with it and just get out there as much as I could. But it wasn't like now where I'm kind of doing this as a job as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, more of a hobby or a jobby or something.
yeah, exactly. But it was very different as well. I mean, it was like very, very different to the work I'm doing now. I didn't go to school for photography. I wasn't like trained and learn, like I didn't really learn about like the history of photography, and you know, I didn't know anything about photo books or all these artists that I'm following now. Like very much when I went traveling and when I took that year off and kind of got back into film, it was almost like a rebirth as a photographer, just in terms of like interests and style and discovering all this new stuff and trying, you know, shifting a lot of how I'd done things for a pretty long time.
Nice. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, just, yeah. Looking at your work now, like, I don't think I've gone back, or if anything's even public from that long ago, but I should probably try to do a deep dive and see if I can find anything.
There's probably a little bit out there. Yeah, I was just going to say it's very different, but I also realize now that like everything we do, you take bits of it with you into your work moving forward. So it all matters.
For sure. Yeah, I wanted to get into like a topic that I like to talk about pretty often is like school in general. So you went to film school. Mm-hmm. Do you like, how was your experience there? Was it pretty good?
Really good.
Do you find that you still use? Oh, really good. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
And I say that because I was never in like an academic person. I really struggled in high school and stuff. I was like into cars and I was like, just wanted to go to like auto class and stuff. So the reason that film school is really good for me though, is I actually went up in Thunder Bay, which is not, not the typical place where you would, maybe that doesn't sound great. I guess when you think of film school, you think of like going to Toronto or something, right? Anyways, there's a college up there that just has the Confederation College in Thunder Bay, has an amazing film program. It was 2 years, but the reason it appealed to me is because they were shooting 16 mil still on Bolexes and on Arriflex. And, you know, your first year you shoot three of your own films and then you have to work on everyone else's. So you're shooting, like you're hands-on, you're working with Bolexes, you're shooting 16 mil. The next year you're shooting with Arriflex SR16s, shooting Super 16. So it was, for me, it was like this opportunity to go somewhere for 2 years, have access to all of this amazing equipment, and just like take advantage of it as much as I possibly could. And I was so into, like, I just discovered that kind of world and I was so into it that it was like a perfect match where I was like, I'm going here for 2 years and I can just like do as much as possible, which was cool. And like the funny enough, the thing that I struggled most with at film school was like the history of film course, you know, where we're like sitting in the lecture theater and I'm like, I can't pay attention.
Yeah, so, for sure. I love to hear that it was actually like a good experience too, because most of the people I talk to are like, I guess because most people are focused on money now too, right? It's like, why would I spend this much money when I could have gone on YouTube to learn all this stuff? But yeah, the fact that it's hands-on, like, you know, I went to a music production school. And I'm kind of in the middle on whether or not it was worth it, and mostly because it was expensive. But, you know, I got to, you know, learn on these huge SSL boards and like all the people that I met there were really sick as well, and like really talented, and all the professors too, like they were really open and stuff. And I think that's the thing that you're supposed to take away from it, is like the practical and like the community from it, you know, mm-hmm, what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like the amount that you learn. And I think you kind of touched on it a little bit before, is like, you know, everything that you do, you learn, and then you bring it to the next thing that you're doing anyways. So you might as well, you know, kind of learn to ask questions too, you know, like when you're on YouTube, you can't like, you can make a comment, but who's going to actually answer your very, very specific comment on filmmaking or music production or camera gear, you know?
For sure.
Yeah.
I think
it's an interesting topic.
Yeah. 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 I think at the end of the day, it all comes down to the person as well. I think mm-hmm. if someone is like self-driven, they're going to make the most of film school, or they're going to, if they can't afford to go to film school or whatever type of school for whatever they're doing, they're just going to make it happen regardless. You know, like there were certainly people that I went to film school with who just, maybe it wasn't the right fit and they just weren't into it. But the people who were really into it and who saw the opportunity to be like, oh my God, like look at what we have here. I'm going to just, you know, do everything I can while I'm here. But at the same time, like, if someone maybe doesn't want to go to school, but they're really self-driven, I think, especially nowadays, like the accessibility and cost of equipment compared to what it used to be, the resources online, like you can make it happen for sure without school. Absolutely. Like, I don't think you need to, I don't think it's a must by any means.
Yeah. I think it's important to realize that there's positives to both sides, right? Like, yeah, if you have the resources to go, most of the time I say go, you know, it's like you might as well meet some people and use some gear and like, but,
well, and it also, I think the one thing with school is like, you're going to this thing and you've paid for it and someone's saying you need to make this now. And that is a really good way to be like, we'll go and make this now, versus like, you got to have like a lot of, self-control, or I don't know,
self-drive
to be like, I'm gonna sit in my home by myself and watch something and now go get gear and organize and find people to help me and book it. Like, not that it's not doable at all, but it's a very different scenario.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, even, you know, the thing too, one of my, I can't remember if he was a professor or I don't know what he did at the school, but he was always like, hey, like I did the math. You're paying this much per day to come here. Mm. You better show up as well and try, you know, or else you're just like doing this for nothing.
That's good.
I always thought that was a good take.
That's a good perspective to give people for sure. Yeah, your reminder.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the self-drive conversation too, something that I found when I went like sort of full-time musician, was that I didn't have any, right? Mm. I was able to quit my job and do it, and then I didn't do anything for like 3 months. Do you have issues with that at all, or are you're pretty good to go, organized?
Yeah, I feel like I've always been. I think it's because I just, maybe a bit of my personality is I'm always like busy. Like I'm like, oh, what can I do next? So I think like for me, it's very. Like for me to wake up on Monday morning, I'm just like, get up to the office. Like, what am I doing? Like, it's very, very much, I guess I just enjoy it a lot. Not all the time, but enough that I am on it as much as possible. I also like, I'm getting older now. I have 2 young kids. So that changed the dynamic completely. Yeah. I'm like, well, can't just not make money. Right? But no, I mean, the times where I struggle the most are, and this is actually doing, YouTube, once I'd switched to doing that as kind of my main source of income, this has been the most challenging time for me throughout my entire career in terms of just struggling with like creative burnout and periods of just feeling like stuck. And I think that's just maybe when the kind of well runs dry a little bit. And you know, it's a weird dynamic when you're like, I need to make something. All I want to do is just not think about cameras for a week or whatever it is. So,
I mean, having a YouTube channel specifically for photography too, it's like, I assume that pressure gets pretty big. I mean, I get it all the time. Like I'll finish a record and then I'll be like, what do I do now? And I'll try to make another project. I'm like, I don't think I could ever write a song again, you know? for like 2 months, and then I'm like, oh God, what am I gonna do? All this stuff. But you know, it even got to the point with me, like I go in spurts, right, where I'm really self-driven and I'm working on a project super into it, and I can work on it 12 hours a day if I wanted to, and then I'll go 3 months completely the opposite. And so like I actually got a day job, you know, at the label that I'm signed to help with that, and ever since then I've actually been way more consistently productive on the music side of things. It's like a really interesting contrast. Even though it's still in music, I'm just excited for afterwards when I can make music, you know, even though I have the ability all the time. It's very strange.
That's interesting to hear, just because that's something I've thought about. And like, I mean, maybe part of it is just not knowing that you don't need to be 100% reliant on your thing. Like I've toyed with that idea many times of like, yeah, what if I, you know, split this up a bit? So it was like 60-40, and all of a sudden, maybe if there was this, you know, I didn't need to be like on 100% of the time with this one thing. I'm not surprised to hear you say that as a result, that made you feel like avoid those like major low points and feel much more excited about what you're doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, it also becomes efficient, you know, like I don't want to procrastinate anymore because I don't have the time to, mm-hmm. you know, whereas before I'd come into the studio like, okay, I'm going to work on a song today. Oh, Kyle McDougall came out with a video. Oh, I missed the last two. I might as well just watch all of them.
<You know? laughs> I am before on board with that. Keep watching. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, whereas now, like, you know, there's the consequence. If I don't do this now, I won't have time tomorrow because I've got these meetings, you know, or whatever. So I might as well just get to it today, you know?
Yeah, no, I could see that for sure. Yeah. I mean, even it's funny we're having this conversation now because I mentioned to you quickly before we started recording, but like I just went through like one of those periods of like feeling majorly stuck and creative burnout. And literally, so today's Tuesday. So all of last week and the 2 days before, so I went Thursday, Friday, and then a full entire week afterwards of trying to come up with an idea for a video. So yes. I went out for 2 days around here and shot nothing. We went away. I went to the seaside for 3 days. I planned out like 4 different videos. I abandoned them. And then it wasn't until yesterday, Monday of this week, where I finally got locked down my idea and wrote a script and shot something. So and I'm just sitting. And then the problem is that I start beating myself up because I'm like, this is like the most inefficient way to work. You know, I could have, if things were rolling, I could have done like 2 videos in that week. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that's why it's really interesting to hear you say that, because it does appeal to me where I'm like, if I scale things back a little bit and shifted a bit of the focus, would that maybe help eliminate some of those periods where I clearly just need to take a break, you know?
Yeah. I guess it trades in the freedom though, right? So like then when you are really in a project and all you want to do is work on it, you can't sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, which I think also helps, you know, it like builds up that, like, I was going to call it anxiety, but it's probably just like, you know, the want to do it. And I think it's really interesting. I don't think it's like a forever thing, you know, but for now, like it's definitely helped. And I've also been in between records, which has helped me a lot, you know, just sometimes, you know, play video games, play Steam Deck for, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours. And you're like, what am I doing? I literally could have finished a song in 2 or 3 hours, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyways, that's a whole thing, but yeah.
I've also just accepted after doing this for a really long time now, like making a living off of photography and video in all these different ways. I've learned and accepted that like, this is how it goes. You know, like the it's sloppy, it's challenging. There's all these periods of self-doubt and questioning what you're doing and uncertainty about your work and your decisions. Like Stephen Pressfield, the author Stephen Pressfield, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's written a bunch of books. One of my favorites is The War of Art. And it's all about, I don't know if you've read it or not, but like, it's like the one I just started reading it at the end of last week. I'm pretty sure it's probably what helped me get my shit together again. But he talks about resistance. You know, he's been a writer for 30 or 40 or 50 years and written all sorts of novels and stuff. But he talks about how there's this resistance that we all face, which, you know, comes in all these different forms. But it's just, yeah, like the places we go rather than just sitting down and doing the work, you know, like the self-doubt. Yes. And the comparison and the, like, we should start writing or composing or photographing, but instead we like check our Instagram or like, it's yeah. just a common thing that never goes away. So I try and keep that in mind all the time now. It's like going back to like, if I'm going to post up a photo or if I'm going to post up a new video and I'm like, is anyone going to like this? Just thinking about that and being like, this is normal. Like, this is how yeah. it goes and how it's always going to go. Hit post. You know, I don't think I'll never be at a point where I'm like 100% like confident and like, everything's amazing, this is gonna be the best, this is gonna, you know, like feeling so yeah. good. It's just, I don't think that's how it is.
Yeah, I think it's tough too, because, you know, with the comparison thing, even if you've gotten past comparing yourself to others, you're still comparing yourself to past work that you've done. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's interesting on a platform that you've chosen to sort of dig into, like YouTube, where all the analytics are public almost. Mm-hmm. Like, how much does that sort of mess with you? Because, like, even on Spotify, music analytics are public, but then on Amazon Music, Apple Music, and all the rest of them, they're all private. And it's much more comfortable to prioritize those for me. Like, how often are you looking at analytics and, like, sort of doing this back and forth comparison thing?
So I was pretty bad with it for a while. Now, honestly, like, I'm at such a good point with it on YouTube, where, like, you have, when you log into your YouTube channel, you get this like channel dashboard, and it shows yeah. you, like, you know, your monthly subscriber kind of average, and then it has this top 10 list, which is the worst. It's like yeah. it's yeah. like for each video you posted, it'll be like, it'll say 1 out of 10, great. It'll even have like little fireworks that go off and be like, people yeah. are connecting with this one. So that can mess with you, because you might post up a video you really like, and then it's like, you know, you check it the next day and it's like 10 out of 10 regular yeah. viewers aren't watching this. And then you're like, oh, is this, you know, is this any good? Anyways, I'm very much past that stuff now, but there was certainly like a long period of time where I'd really kind of obsess over those things. And it's like, even though they're like literal statistics, I still think it, like, it's false. It's, I don't want to say false information, but it's painting a false picture if you're going to base what you do off of those things. Because what I've come to accept is just, like, especially on YouTube, there's going to be certain types of things that appeal to wider audiences. Like, I know if I post up a documentary about another photographer, like a short film, it's going to do nowhere near as good as if I post up, like, you know, the Hasselblad new camera review or whatever.
Yeah, or how to scan 35 millimeter film.
100%, you know? 100%. But, and I'm okay yeah. with that. I'm like, that makes, sure. and I'm also like, that makes sense, right? Like, if yeah. there's people on YouTube and they see, like, you know, a super easy way to scan 35 millimeter, they may be like, oh, I want to go see what that's like, versus, like, you know, a more kind of insightful, deeper, thoughtful piece about an artist's work. So I'm just like, yeah, it, like, I guess I've stopped trying to want things to be different, and I've just accepted it for what it is, which is, as a result, helped me just focus on making the stuff that I think is going to I'll be most happy with.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, I think that's so important, to just let go, just do what you think is best and just let it out. And like you said, you know, it ends up that you know, the audience chooses what's best, you know, for mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, and also thinking about it in different sort of genres for you is really important too. Like, obviously tutorials, depending on the gear or whatever, are going to do much better than like a longer form interview with a photographer that not very many people have heard of, or mm-hmm. something like this, you know, or that's maybe more niche or whatever. Yeah. I think that's really good to just let go like that. I also found that it helped when I started to realize that the views, and at least unique views, were real people. Mm. So like, mm-hmm. even if one of my songs, you know, does really crappy the first week, it's like, oh my god, 5,000 people listen to this still.
Yeah,
I don't, like, you can't even imagine that amount of people. You know, it doesn't matter if there's a million or 500. It's like, that's crazy. People are choosing to listen to this or watch this. Like, whoa.
That's, you know? It's so important. I agree 100%. It's so important to keep that in mind because things have gone so skewed nowadays where we're just like, what we're exposed to are these like mega accounts and stuff. And
yeah,
and,
exactly.
And you're like, someone will be like, I only have 1,000 followers. And it's like, you know, focusing more on like genuine interactions and versus just like mass numbers is, exactly. is really what matters most. But yeah, even remembering that there's real people
yeah.
out there, I think can help not only with being feeling satisfied about whatever engagement you are getting, but also just going back to what we thought about, it can help you stop obsessing over how specific things do. What, just like with what we said, you know, people maybe need some information about how to do X, Y, or Z versus, you know, people looking for a certain thing. Like I'll see people, you know, post rant online and stuff, but like, oh, this is my favorite video. I think it's my best one yet. And of course, you know, like the algorithm, no one watched it. And it's like, maybe it's just not a topic that, maybe it's great.
Exactly.
Could be great. Sure it is, yeah. But maybe it's just not a wide appealing audience. So I think we can really get attached to just like judging all of our work on this like level playing field with the same kind of view of it all. And I think that is a, yeah, not a great way to work because then you just change things, right? You're like, oh, I need to try and get the next one better.
Exactly. And I even tell the artists that I work with, you know, at the label, like when people like start to worry and stuff, it's always about like the first week analytics or even the first year. And I'm like, don't even look at it for like 2-3 years,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
who knows what'll happen. You know, it could catch the algorithm 5 years from now. I've seen it happen a ton of times or get on a playlist or whatever. I think that's another important thing. It's just like, I know you want a million views now, you know, but you know, just give it a couple of years, man, you'll get there.
I posted, there was one time I made this video and I don't even know why, but like, I think I must've messed up when I scheduled it for or something, but it went live at like 6 a.m. right? Like,
oh, wow.
The worst time ever. And I remember like I caught it and I'm like, you know, it was in my top 10 list. It was like the worst ever. It was like 20 people watched it in the first hour. And I was just like shattered. I was like, oh, why did I do this? And I remember just being so upset, which is hilarious to think about that now. But just the other week, this was like 3 years ago. And I just saw it the other week in like my list. You know, it's up to like 40,000 views. And like it's normal where everything else is. And I'm like, yeah, exactly what you said. It's like, you know, put it up there and who knows where it'll be in a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever, down the road.
Exactly. I've done the same thing, even with like, I think I've done it with a full EP once where I put it out and I was like, what are these numbers? Like, oh my God. And I literally took it down and re-uploaded it and it probably did a little bit better, but I'm like, looking back, I'm like, why did I even do that?
Mm.
You know, what if I kept it up and then somebody found it and then like did this whole thing, you know? Cause I think there was like a week or two where it wasn't up, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like missed opportunity, essentially. Obviously, maybe nothing would have happened. But I think it's, yeah, important just not to second guess, you know?
Mm.
Especially if there's a reason. Like, if there was a reason that you put it up at 6 a.m., it's like, stick to that reason. You'll be good, you know?
Yeah, I guess we've never had these, like, metrics. These, like,
yeah, exactly.
Instantaneous metrics available to us. And I think that's maybe just messing with us all a little bit.
Right? Oh, 100% it is.
Because, like, when else could...
Oh, man.
I remember I was doing television, not that I had anything to do with that side of like, you know, network numbers and all that. I'm sure all the salespeople did, but I was just never exposed to any of that. My focus was just like, how can I make this the best possible, right? And the show obviously must have been doing well to keep going, but there was no like, it's not like you sent it off to broadcast and like you watch this ticker, you know, the first hour
exactly.
And you're like, oh no, only 468 people tuned in this in the first 15 minutes or whatever. So
exactly. That's the interesting thing. I mean, I'm sure we could get into a whole side tangent on how like advertising works now based on that, whereas like, you know, back in TV broadcast days, I don't know what metrics they would ever look for, but like, you know, you're sponsored by Squarespace,
mm.
you know? So I guess you have like a lot of the time, I guess you have like firsthand experience of like what they're looking for. Do they have like a threshold? How does this even work? How does sponsorships work?
Yeah, it's the biggest gray area because no one talks about it. You know what I mean? So like when I got connected with Squarespace through this, I guess you could call them an agency. It's like a but it's like a people that I work with who have Squarespace as one of their kind of brands, and they're kind of, you know, do like our agreements and all that kind of stuff. But there was no, like, from in my experience, it wasn't based on like any hard stats. Do you know what I mean? So and that does make me wonder at times. Like, I've had a relationship going with them now for almost 3 years, and I feel like we have a good relationship and they must be happy with how things are going. But I'd be lying if I said there wasn't part of me when, like, we get near the end of the year where I'm just like,
yeah,
I hope it went well. Like, are you, you know, are you coming back? But at the same time, I'm also just like, I value what I've built up and the quality of what I'm putting out there and the engagement I have with my audience. So I try and keep that in mind too, is like, you know, it's valuable for anyone who will get involved with this. But yeah, I think
for sure
social media has been very strange because for me, working in the commercial world, it was very different. Like, you would connect with a company and you'd be like, this is what we can do. And you'd have a conversation, right? And you had like your budget list where you could figure things out. And this is just like, what are other people charging for this? I hope it's, hope it's similar.
Exactly.
So,
yeah, I'm assuming it kind of a lot of the time works as like, you know, if you find it through an agency, maybe they have a partnership with Squarespace where it's like the all of it. And then you get just a sort of cut of your pie, maybe. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have a better idea.
Yeah.
But we don't have to get too much into that. But I did want to get a little bit into like sort of income streams. Mm-hmm. Because, okay, so in music, like there's like the income from DSPs like Spotify and stuff. And then on the side, there's mechanical publishing royalties and all the different types of publishing royalties. And then sync licensing like MusicBed and all this stuff. There's so many things that we can do. In photography specifically, is there anything other than like, I don't know, licensing, you know, in general, or and books obviously, but like, are there like these little micro streams
there? So yes, I guess it all just depends on which avenues you choose. So like for me, there's like obviously the YouTube ad revenue, which would be similar to, I'm assuming, to like your Spotify streams and stuff like that. And then there's sponsorship stuff. And then there's all these little, you can do like, you know, affiliate stuff when you're recommending gear, little bits from there. I don't do any licensing, like image licensing or anything like that, but there obviously still are platforms doing that. And then I have a couple courses online.
Oh yeah, I want to get into that too.
Yeah, so that is something, that's one of the things where I'm like, I need to make more of these because I like the idea of you make them, you put in the time at the start and then it's done. And you don't have to be like, I need to get another course up next week, you know, or whatever.
Exactly.
And then there's a book, the book was a big one for me. And then I just signed on with a gallery here in England.
Oh, nice.
Which will be happening in the next couple of months. So yeah, it's very much like there's a lot of a couple bigger things and then a lot of little things as well.
So for a photographer who didn't want to do any of like the social media stuff, is it even still possible? Like, other than getting lucky and getting like a gallery or a huge book publication or something like this, like, are there still people doing that in your sort of knowledge?
I mean, it all depends on what you want to do, I guess. Like, obviously, if you want to, you know, shoot weddings or be a commercial photographer, and like there's that entire world, which is probably the most straightforward way, or for sure the most straightforward way to go. But I would say if you're trying to work as like a fine artist or someone who maybe creates like fine art pieces and stuff, like, yeah, you could sell prints and you can work with a gallery. But I don't know, the way I look at like social media, again, I never was like, I want to start a YouTube channel and grow it big and stuff. I'm very much not that type of person. It kind of just happened. I love it. I'm very grateful it's worked. But I just look at social media as a whole as just like an extension of the things we were doing in the past. You know, like in the past, before social media, you were still trying to get your name out there. You were still trying to connect with people. I remember making flyers and like mailing people flyers back in the landscape photography days, and going to like trade shows to try and connect with people and all that. So I kind of look at this as much as social media can be crazy and as much as I don't enjoy it at times, it is also like a really incredible way to get your work out there, connect with people, make connections, meet other photographers, all that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, for me, just doing it, it became a job, which and it has allowed me to, you know, just focus on, for the most part, the work I like doing and make a living off of it, which is pretty cool. But,
100%.
I think too, as much as I know people hate it and there are a lot of things I don't like about it, I think personally, not saying everyone needs to go and start a YouTube channel and all this stuff, but missing out on a lot of potential opportunities if you're not using it and you're a photographer who's trying to maybe like to grow like a business or something like that. Fair enough if like someone just does photography for fun and they don't want anything to do with social media, like cool. Like, it's probably not a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Just like sharing your knowledge. You know, a lot of the photography YouTubers that I follow now are, you know, they're well under 10,000 subscribers a lot of the time, mm-hmm. you know, and they're making really quality stuff. I can't think of any names off the top of my head. I wish I could, but yeah, so I mean, so in your videos too, like you use a lot of atmospheric ambient music in general. Is there a reason that you specifically use more of this type of music some of the times, or is like, it's just what you like, it's just what catches your ear?
Honestly, I think it's just what I enjoy. And I think maybe that just carries over from like how I would have approached things in my like video production career and kind of what I was into with that kind of stuff. And maybe just my personality as well. Like, you know, I'm very much like go out by myself, work by myself. I love being in the wilderness. My photography is very slow. You know, the comment I get most from people is that when they say they enjoy like my videos or something, is that they're very like chill and peaceful and relaxing. Like my personality is, it's always weird to hear people tell you how they think you are. But I guess maybe that is just why, like I'm not the type of person who's going to be like a huge personality with, you know, big music and tons of things happening and flashing and whatnot. So yeah, it's kind of honestly, it just all starts from like what I enjoy in the first place as well. Whatever I hear and enjoy. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, from an artist perspective, like it helps us so much, you know, I'm sure people have found my music through some of your videos and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, honestly, and even just like the, Music Bed license, you know, it helps Music Bed push that artist more if like people are using it and like all this stuff. So yeah, it's cool to see somebody using this type of music instead of even lo-fi, you know, everybody uses the lo-fi stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, that's like the meme, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
But it's funny, 'cause like I'll use it every now and then, but I'm just like I think the reason is because like it you can kind of just put it in there and it's going to work, right? Like you can't go get like a death metal song and put it in, like, you know, it's not going to work. Like, so I think it's just like a really easy choice to like put in and it's going to be this kind of like low key thing underneath. But I'll tell you what, it's like when I think back to when I started and even in film school, like how lucky we are nowadays to have access to music, like, you know, yourself, the stuff that you're putting out. Like I remember in film school, we had a CD binder with like this music collection. It was like 48 CDs and it was just like, it was just very kind of generic stock music licensee type music. And then I remember Premium Beat was like one of the first music licensing websites that came out royalty free. And that started to bring just like a little bit of something different. I was using that when doing television, but now I think, you know, nowadays with like Music Bed and actually having like really good music, like it's so, I can't tell you how important it is for me as someone making videos. Like one of the first things I do is I go and I look for music, and then that drives so many creative decisions. So if I can't find something that I actually enjoy and that I feel like is going to, you know, work creatively, it honestly like delays and makes the process so difficult.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, even for us, like I often say that like MusicBed sort of made my career, because I've been with MusicBed for, oh man, we're probably coming up on 10 years, pretty much right when they started. And through them, I've met so many directors and stuff like this, and it's kind of helped me gain like my sort of visual identity for Alaskan Tapes. And even people like you who use it, and it's like, this is the music that fits exploring abandoned areas or doing photography in general. You know, it's like really concreted this like, I don't know, activity based music kind of thing. You know what I mean? And it allows people to stream it during that, and like it's literally how I've made my my living, you know.
That's cool.
So I'm stoked. I always say, like, if I was like 5 years too early, 5 years older, I'd be screwed. For real. Like, oh my god, it never would have worked, you know.
It's interesting with MusicBed. Like, I still remember when they kind of came on the scene. It's when I was doing the video production company, and obviously they came in as more of like a premium, you know, like I think Premium Beat was like, you know, fairly affordable for songs, and MusicBed kind of came in as the more premium option. And you know, I remember as we started to work with bigger brands, and we would license, you know, we would always build in budgets, like licensing tracks from MusicBed. And it was just like such a breath of fresh air again, because it drove so much of like the creative and what we were trying to do. So, I mean, it's really cool now that they've made it available for, you know, platforms like YouTube and stuff like that to be able to work into certain videos and whatnot as well.
Yeah, we got to get you a MusicBed sponsorship.
Oh, I'm affiliate. I have an affiliation with them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I did one video a couple of years back with them. But yeah, I have an affiliation. They're great. Sign up for MusicBed.
Sign up for MusicBed and license Alaskan Tapes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Before we sort of end this off here, I wanted to ask you about your podcast that hasn't been active for like 3-ish years.
The non-existent existent podcast.
It was really good, like especially during the pandemic, like you had all of the photographers on it, you know, the YouTubers, like the Matt Day episode, which I think was one of the first ones, was really, really good. And I was just wondering, like, so you did about 30 episodes, which is almost where I'm at. This is going to be episode 37. Did you just sort of find that project to be completed, or like, did you just, it was too much work, or what was your thoughts there? What happened to it?
Yeah, honestly, like I would love to keep doing it. But for me, it was just as simple as it was something I started doing alongside everything else. And it was the only thing not generating income, which is fine, which is completely fine, except for the fact that from a priority standpoint, it had to be pushed aside often because I was just so busy with trying to do all the other stuff I have to do to run my business. So I came down to like just not having time for it. And I've thought a lot, I really want to start it again. And I've thought a lot about how I can do that. And I think a lot of it comes down to just finding a better way to approach it. Cause I was very much almost maybe trying to be too much of like a perfectionist at times, and things, it would just take way longer than it should have from like I love the idea of sitting down with someone and recording and then not really just uploading the episode, you know, as long as everything's fine, or just, I would do solo episodes often and people seem to enjoy them. But to me, I would always be like, it's just filler. I need to do interviews, but people would be like, well, I really enjoyed those. So I think, it is something I want to start up again. And I think it would be doable if I could make it a lot easier on myself. And not obsess over things as much.
I think I saw one of the solo ones, you had literally taken the audio from a video and uploaded it. Am I right about this?
Maybe. I can't remember, but maybe.
Because I was thinking that'd be another good idea, even just for like the Embracing the Familiar video with Nicholas, Jarrah White. You know, something like that. Because a lot of the time now, personally, and this is a total like, you know, for me, a lot of the content that I consume are like podcasts when I can listen in the car, you know, when I just don't have time to watch a YouTube video or whatever. I think that'd be sweet. And some of my favorite episodes of your podcast were the solo ones as well. Obviously, I love hearing about like Willem and Matt Day and stuff. But that'd be pretty sweet. You're a good like interviewer, and you can even see it in the documentary sort of ones that you do, videos that you do. That'd be sweet to come back.
Yeah,
I do understand the income thing, because it's also the same with me. This is like the one thing I do that doesn't generate income, and that's why it's inconsistent.
Yeah, yeah. That being said, like, it was one of the most enjoyable things I've done, just because I feel like the podcast world is so much different than any other social media platforms. Like, it's long form. People will sit and listen to conversations. It feels so much more relaxed. And then there's also not this, like, you don't got to try and, like, how do I make a thumbnail to get people to listen? Yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? Or, like, there's not a comment section where there's going to be people arguing about if Fujifilm GFX is good or not and whatever. Yeah, like, it just feels like this really normal, pure thing still, where it's like, I know the podcast that I'm a big fan of. Yeah, you'll throw them on in the car, you'll listen for a couple hours. Like, it's just people having a conversation. So, yeah, I like it as a way to kind of dig into just this type of stuff that we talked about today, just more of like the casual realities of the creative world and just putting these things out there.
Exactly. Yeah, just behind the scenes, like, this is how your favorite creator actually talks.
Yeah.
Without being edited, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, even this one, it probably won't be edited too much, but, like, you know, I guess this is a whole other topic, but, you know, I've been editing the podcast through AI. I've been letting it do its thing, and pretty much all it does is it can tell when there's like a 3-second gap, and it'll just put it together. And it does pretty well, and it also takes all of the work out of it.
Nice.
So it's a lot easier,
so you don't have to sit there for 2 hours chopping out little pieces.
Exactly. Yeah. I still go through it afterwards and do the manual stuff, because it doesn't always get it perfect, but yeah, it's not a 5-hour process anymore.
Yeah, that's, you know? That's nice.
Have you thought much about AI and stuff? I know it's such like a common topic now. I don't even like talking about it anymore. But like, are you worried about it or anything?
I did a Q&A video recently, and someone asked me this question, and honestly, up until that point, I hadn't really thought about it. But my kind of answer was, I think for like, if I was someone who was doing like commercial photography or commercial video production, like, I think it's absolutely going to change a lot in those spaces. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, even with like this Sora or whatever, this like text to video, like,
yeah,
we used to, I remember working on commercial shoots where there was like a crew of like 20 over 3 days in, like, you know, new home builds, filming like a family enjoying this new house, and then it would get edited into like a 30-second thing. Like, we're talking huge money to make this, and like, I'm not advocating and saying this is how it should be, but like, it's going to get to a point probably where people can just use the programs to recreate these scenes, and, you know, people are going to take advantage of that. So I think it is certainly, if I were in that world still, it would be like, I would be thinking about it a lot. I think in more of like the world that I'm in as like a photographer working on long-term projects and doing social media and having this kind of like personal brand or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Makes me cringe saying that, but I think that is where it's not as much of a concern to me, because so much of what matters in this world is not only just like the images that I'm making, but also the like personal connection with people and telling your story and sharing experiences. And that's not going to come and get replaced by an AI model. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, people aren't going to be watching videos of like animated robots with AI speaking about whatever, right?
Yeah. I mean, even just the knowledge that you have over like the 20, almost 20 years of doing all this, like, yeah, an AI isn't going to come and do that. But it's the exact same for me. Like, there's that new software. I think it's called Suno.
I haven't heard of it.
It's the music one. It's text to music.
Oh, wow.
And it's high quality.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's a lot of, like, you know, rock and country and rap. So thankfully, it hasn't come to ambient, because it's going to be the easiest thing to generate. But it's going to be interesting. I have the exact same thoughts that you do, where in the commercial field, where like people are doing scores,
mm-hmm.
it's going to change a lot of that. But, you know, for the people who have personal brands and a face and something to say, I think people are still going to find that valuable, you know?
Well, not only that, I think there'll also always be that I think it will get to a point where it's like the AI created thing is maybe the cheap and practical route, but the artist is going to be like the premium route. You know, it's like, sure, I could go and
weed it out.
I could go and, you know, if I could go and get an ambient track made by some AI machine, but if I want to go and, but using an Alaskan Tape song is going to feel so much more like authentic and real and raw. And premium. It's not like I just went. It's kind of like the CD booklet with 48 discs in it full of stock music exactly. tracks versus working with an artist, right?
Yeah, exactly. It'll be doing all the weeding out of my emails for me. Take away those ones that want to do all the work on exposure.
Exposure bucks. You know. Yeah, good stuff.
Oh, yeah. All the time. So to wrap this up, I know that we kind of hit on it at the start, but like what's next? What are you focusing on the next year?
Staying afloat. Yeah. No, I mean, well, yes, obviously that is always the goal, but I think just like, well, a big thing I want to do for sure is obviously keep my YouTube channel going, but also I've been telling myself for a long time that I want to split the focus a little bit. So, I really want to start doing more kind of interactive things with like a community. So like workshops, bring back the podcast, teach workshops in person, and then just really focus on the project up in North Wales and progress with that as much as I can.
With the focus on sort of community and stuff, how much have you thought about things like Patreon or other things like that? Is that something you think about often?
I have, but I think... like it appeals to me and I have given it some thought, but I think over the past couple of years, just as I got this YouTube channel running smoothly and figured out this world, I was so busy that I didn't want to ever start a patron and be like, sign up and just give me some money. You know, like I want to make sure I'm at a place where it's like, if I start this and someone's going to join, there's like specific things that happen and I'm there just because I've seen people start them. And people join and then they just get busy, right? And they're like, sorry, I haven't posted updates for a month and a half. And I know that would happen with me over the past couple of years or even right now. So.
Me too. That's exactly why I haven't either.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see though. I do like that. But also just like, I would love to do some workshops in person just because I miss that the, like small group kind of interaction. And I've been telling myself for honestly like the past year I'm going to do it. I have all these, you know, ideas like structured out, and I don't know if it's like I'm too busy or if maybe it's a little bit of the resistance I was talking about. Yeah,
100%.
But it'll happen soon. Yeah,
that's super exciting. Yeah, anything in person is always good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, I really appreciate you coming on and chatting for the last hour. This was really fun. And honestly, I didn't even get through all my questions. We didn't get into gear at all.
Oh, man.
That'll have to be for episode two.
Yeah, that'll be the one that appeals to the algorithm.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, it'll be a thing where we do part two and then everybody has to go back to part one to get like, you know, the general thing. So it'll be a double.
Start with that one. Start with the gear episode.
Exactly. Cool, man. Yeah, I really appreciate it. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of We All Speak in Poems. If you like this episode, we'd very much appreciate you going and checking out some of Kyle's work through his YouTube channel, through his Instagram, through his books, whatever suits. And we'll catch you on the next one.